Universal Times. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The United States has called on the UN Security Council to approve the strongest possible measures against North Korea following its sixth most powerful nuclear test. U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley said North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's actions cannot be seen as defensive.
But being a nuclear power is not about using those terrible weapons to threaten others. Nuclear powers understand their responsibilities. Kim Jong-un shows no such understanding. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war.
Russia's UN ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, said all council members have condemned the latest test but remains opposed to a military solution.
Many delegations, including ours, I think most of them, said that, A, there is no military solution to the conflict, B, that we have to look for diplomatic and political solution.
Pyongyang claimed it has successfully tested a hydrogen bomb that can fit onto an intercontinental ballistic missile. South Korea said the size of Sunday's blast was about 50 kilotons and warned the North may be preparing for another test. Seoul also announced plans to temporarily deploy four more launchers of a U.S.-deployed anti-missile battery called THAAD. A U.N. Commission of Inquiry Monday said that crimes against humanity are being committed in Burundi. Fatsa Wagugurguz is president of the commission.
La commission est parvenue à la conclusion.
He said since April 2015, the government has perpetuated serious rights abuses, including arbitrary arrests, acts of torture, extrajudicial killings, rape and forced disappearances. That's when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term, a move the opposition called unconstitutional. This is VOA News. Nearly 90,000 Rohingya Muslims are believed now to have fled western Myanmar since a two-week crackdown on insurgent attacks was launched by security forces. The plight of the Muslim minority has raised alarm in the Muslim world. Indonesia's foreign minister visited the country Monday and met with Myanmar officials. In Russia, thousands protested while scores turned out in the Indian city Kolkata, including Debo Priyo Som, who denounced the rampant killings and persecutions.
Has really become the gravest humanitarian crisis that we are seeing in 21st century. So definitely we need to raise our voice so that the Myanmar government can address this and those people are no more meted out with any injustice.
The government of Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has come under growing pressure to protect the Rohingya civilians. After months of negotiation, the Colombian government has reached a temporary ceasefire deal with the country's last active guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army. The announcement made in Ecuador's capital Monday, 2 days before Pope Francis is due to visit Colombia.
Querido pueblo de Colombia, dentro de pocos días,
the Pope Monday said his pilgrimage will be about hope and peace. Francis had pledged to visit Colombia following last year's agreement between the government and the largest rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. The deal with ELN, formerly formed by radical priests in 1964, is a temporary one lasting from October 1 to January 12, but can be extended. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen was criticized Monday for the arrest of his main rival, Kem Sokha, ahead of next year's election. The U.S. expressed its grave concern over the arrest that it said appeared to be politically motivated. Moo Soo Chua is a deputy leader of the opposition Cambodian National Rescue Party. She said the arrest is designed to keep him from taking part in the election.
They have already taken out Mr. Samrangsi, the former leader of the Cambodian National Rescue Party, and now Mr. Kem Sokha. What is in real trouble, in danger right now, it's democracy. And with it, Cambodia as a whole.
The European Union called for Kem Sokha's immediate release. The Syrian army and its allies edged closer to relieving the city of Deir al-Zor from encirclement by Islamic State fighters. The eastern city, with about 93,000 residents, has been besieged for years. Burkina Faso has put new security measures in place following the August 13 attack on a Turkish restaurant in Ouagadougou that killed 19. That includes beefed-up security presence. The jihadist al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb claim responsibility for the attack. World leaders of the BRICS countries meeting in summit in China have called for UN reforms aimed at better representation for developing countries. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I am Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, September the 5th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. Days after being reported missing, Rwandan police on Monday arrested Ms. Diane Shima Rwigara, a leading critic of President Paul Kagame.
It was agreed that today in the morning they would go to police to continue the investigation process. Police decided to go and invoke Article 48 of the law relating to criminal procedure, which gives police the mandate or the power to use force, you know, to bring a suspect, you know, forcibly for questioning.
Edmond Kajire is a reporter in Kigali, Rwanda. In Cameroon, millions of school children have failed to show up for the start of the school year in the country's English-speaking regions, even after the government freed most of the jailed leaders of the Anglophone protests.
The state cannot sit and fold its hands and see people being prevented from going to school. Such a state becomes an irresponsible state in the eyes of the world community. If you prevent somebody from going to school, it cannot be accepted.
Calista's Gentry is the Secretary of State in Cameroon's Ministry of Industries, Mines and Technological Development. In Uganda, the government has accepted to meet the demands to increase the wages of judicial officers. The officers were on strike earlier last week. Those stories, plus the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting to discuss next steps for the international community's response to North Korea's escalating nuclear activities. The stories are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. In Rwanda's capital, Kigali, there was drama at the home of Ms. Diane Rwigara, the woman whose presidential ambitions were stymied after being disqualified to run in the country's last presidential elections in August this year. Last week, stories circulating in various media outlets and on social media were that Ms. Diane Rwigara and her family had been arrested and held incommunicado by Rwanda's police. However, yesterday, Monday afternoon, images started circulating of Rwandan police scaling the gate to the residence of Ms. Rwigara and her family. Video from inside the house shows a very irate Rwigara in a verbal confrontation with a police officer who was attempting to hand her what is said to be police summons. To make sense of this whole situation, I reached reporter Edmond Kajire in Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
Today what happened, around 4 p.m., officers from the Rwanda National Police went there to their home in Kiyovu. I talked to the police spokesperson, Assistant Commissioner of Police, Charles Badeji, earlier, and from what we know, they were supposed to answer a police summon earlier this morning, at around 9 a.m. in the morning, but they never showed up at police. So several times they tried to call them, and they never showed up. So when I talked to Fandewa, they told me that there was a need for the police to go to the home and forcibly enter, you know, to confirm or even to just, you know, bring them for questioning.
The first time they were questioned by police, did they go to the police station?
Yes.
Or the police came to their house?
They did. I think they came and conducted a search, a search in the house. Took a few items and gadgets, including their phones, which, according to the police spokesperson, were handed back to the family. So what happened, they asked them to go, and they will be calling them, you know, once in a while, often, you know, to come and answer a few questions in regard to the investigations, from what we know so far. So I think what we understand is that they asked for some time, I think over the weekend. They wanted a few days to talk to their lawyer. So it was agreed that today in the morning they would go to police to continue the investigation process. So what happened, they never showed up, and police decided to go and invoke Article 48 of the law relating to criminal procedure, which, you know, gives police the mandate or the power to use force, you know, to bring a suspect, you know, forcibly for questioning if they don't respond to police summons. So I talked to the police spokesperson earlier, and he said that when they called them several times and they never responded, and they tried to, you know, they went to their home and hooted several times and nobody was opening, they took a decision to force their way into the house, and that's what happened.
The rumor that Diane Guigara and her family had been taken into custody, had been arrested or disappeared, as some people had claimed, this is something that could have easily been debunked by either the family, by the reporters who, like yourself. Why did it take this long? Why has it been in the media percolating for this long and nobody has actually taken time to go and verify the facts?
Up to now, I mean, journalists have done their best to try and go and see if they can access the home, at least to know if they are not inside. And up to now, we don't understand what could have been the intention of the family barricading itself inside the house. Because last week, Thursday and Friday, we sent journalists there, even, you know, different media houses. I think even VOA sent a reporter there, but there was no access granted to the house.
Mm.
So that in itself created some bit of confusion because people are wondering, if they are not in the house, then why not, you know, grant people access to come and see and indeed confirm that members of the family are not in the house. So, I mean, it was a very confusing issue, and I think police just took the initiative to go and this time go with journalists and then try to, you know, to break in, and then, because either way, it was not, I think the onus was not on police to prove that the family is in the house.
Mm.
So on one part, I believe there was some level of dishonesty from the family itself, because, I mean, I don't understand why they would not come out and actually, you know, speak to whether it's journalists or any other person that would want to talk to them. So up to now, we don't understand. We have not been able to talk to Diane or any member of the family to understand
where are they currently? Are they still at the police station?
The last time I talked to the police spokesperson, they were still at police for questioning, but he said they had not been arrested. He said
so they have not been formally charged with any crimes?
So I think up to now, what we are dealing with are investigations, at least according to what police says. These are investigations which are ongoing. What I understand is that, considering that they have not been responding positively to the police calls and summons, there could be a decision coming to probably detain at least the three of them, because what we understand right now, it is Diane herself and the sister Anne and their mother. And the two brothers were asked to go back home because they have nothing to answer. So far, that's where we stand.
Now, one of the stories that I read was that a couple of reporters, including a VOA reporter, had tried to access the home of the Rigaras, but there was a confrontation at the gate or in the vicinity of the gate with the presidential guard. What's the involvement of the presidential guard in this whole situation?
From what I understand, as you know, the Rigara residence is about maybe some 400 meters away from State House. So from my understanding and from what the police, you know, told us as when we tried to clarify the situation with it, is that the whole area in Kyovu is patrolled by the Republican Guard. Those are the security guys who handle the president's security. So they patrol the whole area. So once they see someone suspicious when they're doing their rounds, then they come and inquire what that person is doing in the area. But from my understanding and from what at least the police told us is that they were not specifically, you know, guarding the Rigara residence, because the confrontation itself happened just a few meters from the Rigara residence.
Mm.
So I did follow up with our journalist when he was, you know, you know, engaged in that confrontation with the security guys. And at this point, we agree that there was an issue of misunderstanding and people not identifying each other, you know, identifying, you know, themselves to each other in a manner that would have allowed them to, you know, to continue doing their job.
Edmond Kajire is a reporter. He was speaking to me from Rwanda's capital, Kigali. In Cameroon, millions of school children have failed to show up for the start of the year in the country's English-speaking regions. Schools have been closed in the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions of Cameroon since November of last year, when lawyers and teachers called for a strike to stop what they described as the overbearing influence of the French language. Moki Edwin Kinseka has this report.
Good morning, children. Oh, that's good.
A teacher at Ndamulung Bilingual High School in Bamenda, Cameroon, is teaching 20 children who have shown up on day one of the school year. At least 70 were expected in the classroom. Schools have been closed in the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions of Cameroon since November last year, when lawyers and teachers called for a strike to stop what they described as the overbearing influence of French. After strike leaders were arrested, pressure groups called for their immediate and unconditional release before resuming classes. Last week, 55 of the 75 Anglophone protesters were released and their charges in a military tribunal dropped. Analysts said it was an important concession to the strikers' demands that could open the way to renewed talks to end the crisis. But separatist groups are asking for Cameroon President Paul Biya to release another 20 people, to call back those who escaped into exile, and to recall 5,000 soldiers deployed to the English-speaking regions before dialogue can begin. Journalist Finian Tim, who was released from jail after 7 months, says the detainees wish to see schools reopen.
We were pleading with our brothers to stop whatever thing they're doing, because what they were doing, like ghost towns, was not helping us in any way. We're pleading with them to instead stop. Schools can go on for me. My children have stayed home. I paid fees last year, close to 1,300,000 francs for all people I sponsored in school. It went like that. So why should I tell my children to stay home again?
The government sent senior officials to the Anglophone regions to convince parents to send their children to school. The Secretary of State in the Ministry of Industries, Mines and Technological Development, Phou Callistus Gentry, visited northwestern Cameroon.
The state cannot sit and fold its hands and see people being prevented from going to school. Such a state becomes an irresponsible state in the eyes of the world community. If you prevent somebody from going to school, it cannot be accepted.
President Biya has announced reforms in response to the strike, like a new common law division at the Supreme Court, the creation of English departments at the country's School of Magistracy, and the appointment of the first Anglophone to head the judicial bench of the Supreme Court. But he has said that he will engage in no dialogue that threatens national unity. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Bamenda, Cameroon.
Heavy downfalls continue in Freetown and other parts of Sierra Leone, causing flooding as well as small-scale mudslides. The humanitarian community is apprehensive that the worst might yet come. Red Cross Sierra Leone spokesman Abubakar Tarawali tells reporter Ricky Shryuk about relief efforts and long-term solutions to flooding in Freetown.
The main concern now is addressing the needs of the most affected persons. As we all know, about 1,600 or 1,900 families have been affected so far. The primary focus for us humanitarian organizations now is how we address the immediate needs of those affected families. I mean, those needs linger around the provision of shelter for them, addressing needs such as food, medical assistance, among others, including water and sanitation needs.
As I understand it as well, there is a significant amount of rainfall going on right now. Does that make relief efforts that much harder?
It is a challenge. Freetown and the entire Sierra Leone, as a matter of fact, experiences heavy downpour rain between the months of July and September. July, August, and September are the peak of the rainy season in Sierra Leone. And these are the months where normally we experience disasters related to rains or disasters that happen as a result of heavy downpour of rains like we're experiencing now. I mean, apart from the 14th August incident, Freetown and other parts of Sierra Leone continue to experience flooding and similar incidents of mudslide of lesser magnitude, but also affecting communities and destroying houses and property. Even as recent as now, we're still experiencing heavy downpour of rains in Freetown. Everybody remains apprehensive, including us humanitarian workers. I mean, in 2015, about 2 or 3 years ago, the flooding that affected people and displaced thousands of people in Freetown also happened in September. So we are still apprehensive that all is not done yet.
You are someone who is on the ground, who sees firsthand some of the devastation. What do you think the long-term solutions are?
The long-term solution is relocation of people who are inhabiting in those areas that are disaster prone communities. I mean, that's the long-term solution. That's the best solution that can happen. But also, it has to leave us with a question of how do you go about this relocation? Where do you relocate them? And how do you make those communities where you relocate them adaptable? How do you make it a community where these people will be happy to stay? Particularly when you're talking about relocating people in an urban setting.
That was Abubakar Tariwari, Red Cross Sierra Leone spokesperson. He was speaking to reporter Ricky Shryuk from Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. And the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on Monday to discuss next steps for the international community's response to North Korea's escalating nuclear activities. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the United Nations that the U.S. envoy Nikki Haley had strong words for Pyongyang.
Ambassador Haley delivered a stern warning to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war. War is never something the United States wants. We don't want it now. But our country's patience is not unlimited. We will defend our allies and our territory.
Washington warned Sunday of a massive military response if North Korea threatens the United States, its Pacific Island territory of Guam, or America's allies. The United States is also preparing additional unilateral sanctions to impose on North Korea. Ambassador Haley told council members that more than two decades of diplomatic efforts and international sanctions have failed to change the regime's calculus.
To the members of the Security Council, I must say enough is enough. We have taken an incremental approach, and despite the best of intentions, it has not worked.
She said the United States would circulate a new draft sanctions resolution to council members and hopes to quickly put it to a vote next Monday. The council just adopted its toughest measures yet on the regime 1 month ago. Both the South Korean and Japanese envoys, as well as several council members, echoed the U.S. call for more robust international sanctions. Chinese envoy Liu Zhiyi condemned North Korea's nuclear test and insisted the crisis must be solved through dialogue. He's heard here through an interpreter.
The situation on the peninsula is deteriorating constantly as we speak, falling into a vicious circle. The peninsula issue must be resolved peacefully. China will never allow chaos and war on the peninsula.
Russia's envoy urged parties to maintain a cool head and refrain from any action that could further escalate tensions. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The Ugandan government has accepted to meet demands of increasing remuneration for judicial officers that went on strike earlier last week. Kahinda Otafire, Uganda's justice minister, says that the government will start by providing privileges entitled to judges and magistrates and other judicial officers in the country. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala.
Judicial officers went on strike asking the government to increase their salary, transport, medical insurance, housing allowance, as well as providing them with security guards. Minister Otafire says the government is concerned about the demands of judicial officers.
Government has committed to address the judicial officers' working conditions by providing transport, security, and office equipment. In the medium term, government will focus on providing housing for judicial officers and review their emoluments in tandem with other public servants.
For example, judicial officers want the highest officer's salary to be increased from the current 20 million Uganda shillings or around $6,000 to 55 million Uganda shillings or about $15,000. Otafiri says the cabinet is working on a salary structure for all government officers.
There is a lot of disparity within the pay structure of government workers. Cabinet directed the Ministry of Public Service to harmonize pay for all workers of government, all of them. So if we start now awarding pay increases to judicial officers only, then we are likely now to aggravate a situation that is not healthy.
Many courtrooms and offices remained closed last week, and many cases were not heard before the courts of law because of the judges' strike. Otafiri says judicial officers should resume work immediately.
Government appeals to all judicial officers to return to work as government addresses their concerns and that those of other public officers. Government further appeals to the other public officers who are demanding for salary enhancement to be patient as government fast tracks the harmonization of pay across government.
Otafiri says most of judicial officers' demands will be granted by next month. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rakarin in Kampala, Uganda.
And that's it for this Tuesday, September the 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a good day, Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.